Since I stand a better chance of making some headway with the Commissar on the corner than I do with an H-bomb in the warhead of a missile, which can't talk back, I would rather see the values that I prize survive as a leaven in a society which is dynamic and evolving even though it has overrun mine, than see them blotted out completely without even the chance that their remote descendants, conceptually, will reflect what I held dear.
I'd like to point out something here that I think is quite important in the world today. Various ex-British colonies have now been, I don't know whether you want to call them abandoned to their fate or given their freedom. Various British colonies have been allowed to go their own way. Also, various French colonies have been allowed to go their own way. The British were characterized in their colonial affairs by interfering rather massively with the native customs and imposing on the natives many British customs. The French did not do so. The French did not impose their customs on the natives. They merely made the natives supply them with what they wanted. The result of these two different approaches to the colonial problem has been that each of the British colonies that has now been gone its own way has shown considerable and very greater degree of self-discipline and calm transition than have any of the French colonies. Okay, show me I'm wrong.
Well, Mr. Campbell, if you don't mind my adducing the personal experience that I have, we have living with us in our apartment a young Nigerian economics student. And on the basis of the information which he, as a politically aware Nigerian, has given me about the setup in that country today, and on the basis of what seems to be happening in India after Nehru's death, and on the basis of what seems to be happening in Pakistan, when a Chief Justice of Pakistan can, at this Empire Legal Conference, Commonwealth Legal Conference, talk about cutting off hands of thieves in order to prevent a recurrence of the crime, it seems to me that by imposing forcibly from above their own foreign customs upon their colonial peoples, the British have put a mask on, and the mask is now breaking. Nigeria is a particularly striking example because, as you probably know, the Nigerians are arbitrarily combined from three basic cultural streams, the Hausa, the Yoruba, and the Igbo. Now, the Muslim Hausa of the north have a strong paternalist North African tradition, and this suited the British very well when they came in. They found this Muslim tradition congenial to their own Victorian public school behavior, if you like. Their legal system was recognizably adaptable. And by and large, the influential governors of Nigeria, when it was a British colony, relied upon the administrators of the Muslim Hausa rather than upon the tribal headman system of the Yoruba or the Igbo. This, unfortunately, produced an extremely unstable situation, because when people who did not belong to the northern Muslim tradition found themselves cast loose in their company, they not unnaturally took the face value of the British principles which they'd been handed and said, "We wish to govern ourselves. We do not wish to be ordered about by somebody who has been arbitrarily combined into our country by the invasion of a foreign power." And Nigeria is going to go through some very awful growing pains as soon as the superficial generation of British-trained administrators is replaced by people who are now having to fuse the externally imposed customs with the actual traditions of the people below. On the other hand, the French, who did not impose public school traditions and this kind of thing on their colonies, did educate to an extremely literate degree a large number of their black colonials. And it comes as something of a shock to hear somebody from Mali, for example, speaking perfect Sorbonne French, but he does, and he reads Racine in the original. He has a a greater understanding on the emotional level of the culture of the people who have been his colonial governors than those who were subjected to an alien imposed system such as the British. Now, I do not wish to be taken as making a general attack on the British Empire and Commonwealth, because I think that if this country in the long run is remembered for anything admirable, it is going to be as a bringer of language and laws. And this is what I'd like to see happen.
I feel that Nigeria is as unstable as the Congo.
Was the Congo, but the Congo was a Belgian possession, and until 19... In fact, the Congo was run for a very long time as the private estate of King Leopold, and
the Congo is in just as much of a turmoil now, anyway.
But there are two factors operating here. One is the fact that Belgium only very reluctantly took over the administration of the Congo. If you check back over the records, in about 1908, I think it was, when it passed out of the personal possession of the Belgian royal family after the slave trading scandals, the Belgian government only accepted the dominion over the Belgian Congo very reluctantly by a small parliamentary majority. Incidentally, when you say Belgian traditions in France, French traditions in Belgium, I hope there are no Belgians listening, especially not any Flemish-speaking Belgians. That's a country which is split down the middle as badly as any in Africa, and in fact it's a European example of exactly the same thing that has happened in all these places where arbitrary European-imposed boundaries have cut across tribal and linguistic groupings in Africa, because the fact that the Spanish Netherlands was a subject colony of Spain led to this present mess in Belgium, where you get Walloons and Flemings rioting in the streets, and this is paradoxical in a modern Western European country. I'm sorry, I could go on to enormous length about this, but I mustn't.
Can I just cut in two comments from the floor? Gentlemen over here.
Could I ask Mr. Brunner exactly what he's talking about? it seemed to me that he's just going on and going on and going on, giving these examples of systems which have, in his own words, the seeds of their own destruction, and using them, and using these examples to destroy something he's previously been supporting. Now, can he rationalise what he's been saying on the past half
hour? I've been told by the moderator to answer that briefly. I say this is impossible. For me, at any rate. Seeds of its own destruction. A panel discussion like this, on a subject like this, contains within it the seeds of its own destruction, because, as I think has been abundantly illustrated, though there are various poles of opinion taking part in it, we haven't yet, after all the time I've been talking, established the factual basis of the various examples we've been adducing. And accordingly, I will not attempt to sum up what I've been saying like that, but I'll probably go on talking about it for the rest of my life.
Jimmy?
Oh, this is quite a long way back.
Well,
we did start this panel talking about the men and the white horse and the truth. Well, I'd like to make three quick points. 2,000 years ago, a man asked, what is truth? And nobody's given him an answer yet. The other is a little story that's told of the devil and a friend who was walking down the street, and a man in front of them picked up something. The devil's friend, did you see that? He picked up a piece of the truth. The devil turned round and said, yes. It was only a piece of the truth. I shall let him organise it. I'll get them both in the end. The third point is, technologically, we are very advanced. We are so damn advanced that we've frightened ourselves to death with it. Emotionally, we are not grown up. Otherwise, we wouldn't have these god-awful wars. When your man on the white horse comes along, we're going to do the same as we did 2,000 years ago. It's going to offer us the truth, and we're going to stand there and say, crucify him.
I think I might point out that we're virtually suggesting that this man on the white horse is never going to come.
I thought that was a good
order. May I suggest, too, that The man on the white horse has come along once in a while and done a great deal of good for the people to whom he came. The trouble is that almost invariably the son of the man on the white horse should have been strangled at birth. The only system that will work is when you have a man on a white horse surrounded by a number of other men on white ponies. In other words, it must be a hierarchical system. May I point out that the most stable government that has ever been devised by human beings and has remained functional for over 1,500 years is that of the Catholic Church. It is a government. It is a hierarchical system. And it has remained functional for far longer than any other government that has ever been developed by mankind.
However, the Catholic Church does not rule over an industrial society.
True.
And that makes a somewhat different situation.
Neither does
where the change
the Ninevites, the Egyptians, the Romans, the Greeks, or any of those others that didn't last 1,500 years.
The Catholic Church rules a society that is very slowly changes at all. This is somewhat different than an industrial society.
Well, all those other governments I mentioned didn't last 1,500 years either. They didn't have the problem with an industrial society either.
All right, but we don't have either of those situations.
Well, it has been said just now, rather a few minutes back, that men on white horses have been doing some good. In fact, I'm not going to deny that. But what I do deny is that the white horse goes driving in the sky is in itself a safe concept. I say I do everything in my power to eliminate the need, the emotional need for people to have such a white horse ghost rider, because I don't think it's anything about that. They're delegating their own responsibility, which I think they have, and they can be made to have, to someone else.
I would say that you need a man on a white horse to accommodate that, to actually get them going on along those lines.
That's not the case. Gentlemen, again.
My point was with respect to the Catholic Church. Might I suggest that possibly a stable, benevolent dictatorship is one which is organized on some particular foundation, such that if conditions change and the foundation no longer applies, there is then an immediate threat of instability, as is the case at the present time with the Roman Catholic attitude to birth control. Which has now become a major issue owing to the rising population in this century.
But I do wish that, at least to recognize that this is a form of government, which it truly is, and that it has survived 1,500 years, which is far in excess of the greatest achievement of any other form of government that man has ever produced. It is perfectly true that a benevolent dictatorship is the finest form of government man can have. As I pointed out in an editorial some while back, it has long been held that heaven and hell are both absolute monarchies. The trouble is that it's heaven when you have a benevolent dictator, and it's hell when he isn't benevolent. The problem is to set up a system that will selectively promote to the head man post a benevolent personality. Somehow the Catholic Church has managed to do that better than anybody else that's come along. Agreed, they have been freed of many of the problems that a political government encounters. But let's study it, let's abstract from that something that has been working. I don't know what particular factor it is that made it work, but thank God that we ought to study it.
Well, wouldn't you say that, as one example, the Pharaoh system of rule in Egypt lasted longer than the Catholic Church has done so far?
How many different dynasties were there in Egypt?
There were quite a lot of different dynasties, but what was different about the Sultan set up there?
Well, as far as I could make out, they sort of took turns in being dynasties, because first it was one people, then it was another people, then it was another people. They all called themselves pharaohs, but it didn't make...
Well, did you see any essential social differences that he set up? Was the sort of government they had there, the society they had, was it really differentiating along the varying dynasties? I don't think.
In that case, there's another group of governments that should be studied. I want to know how they do it. I don't want to argue about who did it, but I want to know how it was done.
It's about three people down here, though. The gentleman over here I saw first.
If I might get back to the Catholic Church, I should think one of the most hopeful signs about that type of government, and why I'm inclined to agree with the general of what John Campbell said about it, are that it does seem to have surmounted some of the difficulties which forms of government come against. It surmounted, for example, the incredible state that one time it was divided in two. It managed to reunite itself. There was something within the setup that created that situation, rather than a continued fissuring, breaking up, the sort of way the Roman Empire tended to break up. Something brought the Catholic Church together. I mean, as a believing Christian, I can give you an answer, but I'll leave it out for the moment. The other thing is that in the present time, one of the most hopeful things about the Catholic Church is that it showed every sign of trying to modify itself, having to deal with certain problems, for example, the birth control problem. Admittedly, it's producing controversy, but the Catholic Church is trying to work out an attitude to that, to deal with the problem, not running away from it, not laughing it off, and not falling, as we hardly can see, to bits of
it. Incidentally, I think it's necessary for me to make at this point one comment. I myself am not a Catholic. If anything, I'm a Unitarian. I'm not saying that the Catholic faith is the only one anyone should accept. All I'm saying is, let us study a form of government that worked. The Catholic Church's government has been a self-repairing organism. That, in essence, is what you're saying. Most governments have proven to be completely incapable of self-repair.
There are about four people from the floor. Mr.
Campbell, are you saying the Catholic Church is a benevolent dictatorship?
No.
No, I said that the Catholic Church's form of government is a benevolent dictatorship.
Can you justify that?
What?
Can you justify that statement?
Well, certainly the Pope is a benevolent dictator.
Hence the Inquisition, sir.
Inquisition.
Hence the Inquisition.
What?
Hence the Inquisition. I'm blessing the
Yes, you know, in other words, your questioning is benevolence.
Yeah.
Now, that is always open the question, but you must remember, and this is one of the great difficulties with sincere benevolence. The Torquemada, the chief inquisitioner in Spain, was a very sincerely devoted man who recognized that it was much more important to save a man's soul, so that if he could save a man's soul by breaking his body on the rack, he was doing the man a great favor. He was benevolent.
I'm sorry that John Wyndham isn't here, because he has some rather strong views on the question of the Catholic Church as a benevolent dictatorship, since he spent a holiday in the Canaries. Benevolent from whose point of view is the problem that we are trying to get at, and it seems to me that the fundamental flaw in... This has not in fact been advocated by John Campbell, he's simply advocating studying the Catholic Church. But it seems to me the fundamental flaw in expecting to derive a solution from the study of benevolent dictatorships to the organization of human society lies here. There has as yet been no dictatorship, benevolent or otherwise, which was capable of envisaging its own phoenix-like reconstruction. If the Catholic Church were confronted, as in fact the Inquisitor in Dostoevsky is confronted, with the return of Jesus Christ, it would not cede authority to its founder. It would not accept a new dispensation. And essentially, in a changing world, this is what we need, a form of government that will accept a new dispensation, not from Jesus Christ, but from the circumstances around it.
Just by saying one remark. I agree with you, and I'd just like to add that so far there has not been any form of dictatorship, or any particular dictatorship, that has been able to make the most economic use of its potentialities.
Did you want to speak? Well, I wanted to come to exactly that point, because each dictatorship is producing people who still need some kind of dictatorship. They are not getting, well, in any sense, not getting free. They are not getting people who can move around by themselves. They have to be moved. And that's the cause why these dictatorships are in no kind economic.
Quite so, because dictatorships have the habit of breeding white horses.
Surely all this talk about Roman Catholics set up being a form of government is irrelevant, because surely they don't cater for any physical needs, which is what a political setup should do, and we're not talking about politics.
My friend, you're somewhat overlooking the fact that the Catholic Church does own an immense amount of physical property. That one of the problems of any bishop or any cardinal is to maintain the necessary accounting system to keep track of the economics of his very large domain. He does not have a temporal government in the normal sense, but they do have the problem of regulating many thousands of human beings and a huge amount of physical property. Don't forget the Catholic school system, which is one of the largest, if not the largest, on the planet.
Surely all this is set up, though, to maintain their own system.
But they do it! What is any school system set up for? Precisely that point, to maintain its own system. For instance, in the United States, the Amishmen, the Pennsylvania Dutch, will not send their children to the state-supported schools. They don't want them to be led astray. They don't want them to learn these improper ways of living. Because the state school, of course, is teaching the state's philosophy. So what's the difference?
Listen, I quote a very recent example of direct influence that the Vatican has taken upon the government. Some time ago, the Italian government intended to introduce a new legislation on stocks owned by companies. And Vatican actually prevented that bill, which would have provided for their paying taxes for the immense stock they are holding, by threatening to sell their stock. And this was enough of a threat to kill that bill. It never came through.
This is one of the reasons why more and more Italians are voting Catholic.
Agreed. Also, remember that the Catholic Church got into a great deal of trouble with Herr Hitler.
Hitler would never have gone as far as he has done if it wasn't for the fact that the Church, the entire catholic hierarchy in Germany was 100% in favor of Hitler, and that's a fact that should not be forgotten. And the Spiegel, our national political magazine, has just ceased to publish a serial on these events. It's a lie, it's an outright lie to say that the Catholic Church has opposed Hitler all along. It's Christian history.
My data may be mistaken. I haven't made a study of it, but I...
American historian has written just a book about this.
The Catholic Church has, however, a very large physical plant and a very large number of people. And by this I mean priests, nuns, so forth, who are entirely under the control of the Catholic government. And it is, it's not that I am praising Catholicism, it's just that I want to find out what they've got that we can use. I will agree with John Butler completely that they don't have all the answers we want. But if we can get one piece of an answer from them, and one piece of an answer from the Egyptian pharaohs, and one piece of an answer from the Incas, let's get the pieces.
We're going to have to line up fairly soon, so can we just have the question? Fairly shortly.
I'd like to point out one thing, that since you're interested in knowing what they've got that makes it tick, I'd like to point out that they've got a theology which is based on a set of assumptions about the nature of man which are 180 degrees out of phase, diametrically opposed to the assumptions that you've been laying down here today.
Right. Okay. But so far as having a theology and a set of assumptions, Hitler said they were going to have a 1,000-year Reich because they had a set of assumptions and, in effect, a theology. The communists...
They weren't based on the concept of love your neighbor, which is an impossible dictum, according to you, and therefore unethical.
I didn't say it was
impossible. General, unethical.
I didn't say it.
I would like to oppose what the last speaker said. It's the point I was going to make. That, in my view, that which is valuable in the Catholic Church is the work done on the basis of the work carried out by Thomas Aquinas. Now, you get this vast struggle in the Catholic Church, a mass of superstition and bigotry and prejudice, but somewhere you do get a whole body of people who do actually try and look at the objective hard facts and the human facts, and that this is based on the work done by Aquinas, who in turn incorporated in his work the work done by Aristotle. Now, these are only a very small portion of the Catholic Church, and they often lose out. But I would suggest that the fact that we were able to build up in the last couple of centuries a fairly sound attitude towards the physical world, a whole set of sciences, is due to a much larger degree than most people realize to the influence of Thomas Aquinas as distributed through the Catholic Church.
I would second that.
They have widely paid attention to Machiavelli.
Any more points for the book?
Galileo Galilei.
One I'd like to make is that I think it's significant that the Catholic Church and most successful forms of government have been not self-repairing, as Campbell would have us think. They're not self-repairing under the same blueprint. They're self-repairing under a blueprint which fits. This is evolution, this is change. It is a slow evolution, but this, I believe, firmly, is their secret, the point of their success. You brought up before Galileo. Now, Galileo was a stupid little twit. He was behind the time scientifically at the time. The foremost cosmologist of the time was a cardinal of the Roman Catholic Church. Galileo wrote to him, expanded his ideas, and said, I am right, I am going to publish, and under the scientific technology and otherwise, those that day, he could not improve. The cardinal wrote back to him and said, the method is against you. All you've got to do is shut up until we can prove it. And he wouldn't shut up until he was pre-proved, and so he was squashed. So it's right.
Many times in human history, the greatest authority at the time has produced essentially similar statements. I was much struck by the comment that Forrest Ray Moulton made in his textbook Astronomy, which appeared in 1930. He was about the greatest authority on astrophysics in America at that time. And in his chapter on meteors, he starts off by talking about these romances about interplanetary voyages and says that anyone who knows anything about the physical forces operating between the planets knows that such things are forever impossible. Now, inasmuch as Oberth had done his work, and Hohmann had done his work, and Goddard had already been working with liquid fuel rockets. Very much like the position of Galileo, the guy at that time was talking about interplanetary voyages, the light. You've always got some great authority who knows for sure that it can't be done, ever.
Because he has knowledge
from his religion as... So, I don't mean this in a literal sense, but if somebody denies or refuses to see reality, even if it's shoved down his throat, I found out that invariably this is due to his being ingrained to a certain ideology, which just doesn't allow him to see.
May I make just one slight correction? Not religion, not theology, from his Bible.
Ideology,
Remember that Bible means library. That's where they get their ultimate knowledge.
One last comment from the floor, yes?
Mr. Campbell is wrong when he says, first, his history is all wrong, when he says the Roman Catholic Church has survived 1,500 years. The Roman Catholic Church as such has possibly been in existence for the last 800 or 900 years, certainly not 1,500. The gentleman on the floor is wrong when he says it has survived indivisible. The Greek Orthodox, Russian Orthodox, and various other Orthodox faiths are living evidence of the fact that there's been at least one major split. And I would further argue that the Catholic Church, as such, is not the surviving government of which Mr. Campbell talks, which repairs itself and which produces its own white horse, but rather the bureaucracy which animates the Catholic Church, that bureaucracy which has survived unchanged throughout the entire Roman Empire, throughout the Eastern Roman Empire, the Western Roman Empire, the tax gatherer, not the Pope, the departmental head, not the bishop or the cardinal. These men have survived. These men have survived no matter what change of government on the outside. These men always will survive. The democracies, the dictatorships, the monarchies, whatever. These men are necessary within the government. They are a government, they are an independent, and they are an eternal government.
See, really, very interesting viewpoint. I don't know that I completely agree with you. But if we accept that the Catholic Church is only about 850 years old, here's some interesting question. In that case, what is the oldest still functioning government on Earth?
One thing I was not quite getting out of this panel was the views held by the individual members here and people from the floor. What exactly was in science fiction that had direct relation to politics? What could science fiction give to politics as it is practiced? Well, I've mentioned the fundamental thing of reason as the prime criterion of the belief, or rather the knowledge that the method of verification or falsification could also be adapted and adapted to politics. So I wonder what your opinion now on this.
Perhaps the best answer to the question, what can science fiction do for politics, is very simple. It can provide a forum, and that is the sole duty of science fiction. It's up to the authors to provide the different viewpoints. As a forum, science fiction should not devote itself entirely to showing how wonderful the present systems are. Those are already getting an adequate forum. Science fiction should explore, provide a forum for exploration of non-current and non-orthodox ideas. The orthodox ideas have plenty of opportunity.
Joe wants to make last comment.
As far as I'm concerned, science fiction can really do nothing for politics. Nothing significant, that is. Perhaps it can act as a forum, but really, nobody's going to take any notice of it. What I can say is that perhaps politics can do something for science fiction and provide it with enough ideas to provide us with some good stories.
Yeah, John Brown.
Just 2 points, Mr. Chairman. First, I have a horrible suspicion that there is now going to be an enormous spate of stories appearing in analogue, written by the authors who have been sitting attentively in the body of this hall, all of which will deal with the question of how best a government may become evolutionarily self-perpetuating. I sincerely hope we will also get some stories which question the idea that it is a good thing for any government to be evolutionarily self-perpetuating. But I think, well, I was struck by a horrible thought. There is, in fact, to the best of my knowledge and belief in the world today, only one system of government which actually envisages its own discontinuation. And that, of course, is the communist system, which envisages the advent of the post-state state. This is rather a daunting thought. Politics and science fiction are obviously a combination which are productive of a very stimulating discussion, even though it may not lead anywhere in particular. But the function of contemporary science fiction isn't necessarily to lead anywhere because, after all, the utopia is essentially an out-of-date form. If we can get in the magazines over the next few years stories which reflect as much simulating thinking as the discussion we've had this afternoon, I look forward to it with great enthusiasm.
Right, we'll wind up there. Thank you very much, all the panel.